From Antalya, Turkey, I'm Suzak Verlat, the Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma, and welcome to Worldviews. Joshua Landis and I report today from the Turkish Riviera along the Mediterranean coast and offer our impressions of this growing, prospering, and fascinating country.
Turkey now has $30 billion worth of trade per year with Russia, which is two times the amount of trade it had with the United States.
And I'll talk about appreciating art in the 21st century with Desmond Shaw Taylor and Anna Summers Cox.
I got so excited. I thought, my goodness me, this has got over the problem that you can't ever in a museum get really close enough to something.
That's, I think, the essence of a work of art. Its soul is released from the actual object.
Shaw Taylor manages Queen Elizabeth's art collection across the United Kingdom, and Anna Summers Cox is the founder and editor of the art newspaper. These conversations after this hour's news. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzak Rolat. Joshua Landis, here we are in Antalya, Turkey, in the southern part of Turkey, along the Mediterranean coast. This is known as the Turkish Riviera. We're surrounded on one side by beautiful Taurus Mountains, on the other side by the sea. A city of about 1 million people is just bustling down here, booming. This country is amazing. What's going on here in Turkey?
Well, Turkey is one of the BRIC countries. It's one of these rapidly developing countries. Since 2000, 5% growth per year in a tough neighborhood. Syria, revolution next door. Iran, under severe sanctions. Georgia, which has been in political turmoil up to the northeast. Greece, Cyprus, both melting down. So Turkey is an island of growth, industrialization, $15,000 per capita income. And this city and this country is just booming. There are tons of languages, 35 million visitors a year, tourists. It is one of the biggest tourist destinations, incredible mix of peoples, cultures, vibrant.
It's very clear this is a very diverse country. I think that's the one thing that we've definitely noticed since we've been here. Income inequality is falling, as you said. I mean, they've had 10 years of magnificent growth, 5% a year at least. The industrial sector, construction, service industry, banking. But all of this really being made possible because of moderate politics, right? I mean, it's the leaders of today that are regulating all of this and making sure that the moderate forces are the ones that drive this country forward.
Well, the Prime Minister, Erdogan, has won three elections in a row, each with a bigger majority than the last. And he has created this new path for Turkey, neither east nor west. Turkey was pushed out. Its attempt to get into the EU failed, and it's shifted to the east. Now, this happened also at a time when communism collapsed, and Turkey now has $30 billion worth of trade per year with Russia, which is two times the amount of trade it had with the United States. During the Cold War, it had almost no trade with Russia. Now it has pipelines going from Baku and gas and oil pipelines coming through Turkey, big means of fulfilling their own energy needs, but also making transport fees. And they've opened up to Iran. They've begun to run into trouble with the United States on Iran because Turkey did not want Iran to have these severe sanctions put on it because they wanted to build pipelines and so forth to bring Iranian oil and gas to Europe. America has put the kibosh on those plans. But moderation has been at the center of Erdogan's policy. Its foreign policy is based around what it calls no problems, zero problems with neighbors. And it has tried to bring Greece, Armenia, some of the more vexed relationships that it has into much better balance and to use play all ends off against the middle.
I mean, clearly, Turkey is right in the heart of the world, if you will. I mean, it is the crossroads. I think the thing that's really stuck out to me in our 2 weeks here is that it is a magnet for people from all around the world, not just tourists. I mean, this place is crawling with Russians and people from all over the Middle East. It's, you know, Africa is looking now to Turkey. I mean, there's trade, as you mentioned, trade going everywhere. But this is still a very tricky and challenging neighborhood, right? You would never know sitting here on the southern coast of Turkey that just down the road, there's war in Syria.
400,000 Syrian refugees in southern Turkey today. It is an explosive situation, and things could go wrong so easily. And you get that sense, and every Turk you talk to is anxious. Bombs went off in southern Turkey. We believe Syria was behind them. And all the businessmen in Istanbul were terrified because that 35 million visitors could dry up if there is political instability. Much of this explosive growth could turn downwards. And so Turkey is trying to balance constantly, as you said, play this middle road and keep stability in the neighborhood.
Not only with its neighbors, but internally as well, right? I mean, they have the Kurdish question in the east. They have, you know, some challenges to the moderate politicians in this country, the conservative force, the fundamentalists that are moving. I mean, what are we to expect in terms of longer-term political stability in Turkey?
Well, everywhere you go, you hear people debating. Is the Erdogan government leading a democratic transition, or is it moving towards a more Islamic authoritarianism? And that we've heard views from every side. Many people think that Erdogan is doing the right thing. Others believe that he is bringing the headscarf back and that this is a slippery slope towards some new form of authoritarianism, and they're very anxious.
Well, despite the anxiety, it's certainly a beautiful country and one that the students from the University of Oklahoma are enjoying very much, and so are we. So reporting once again from Antalya, Turkey in the south. Next, we're headed to the center of the country in Ankara, and we'll report from there.
It's a pleasure.
If you have a comment about this program or a question for any of our panelists, let us know by email at worldviews@ou.edu. You can also follow the broadcast on Twitter at WorldviewsKGOU. Coming up, British art historians Desmond Shaw Taylor and Anna Summers Cox join me for a conversation about appreciating art with 21st century technology. I'm Suzak Rolat, and this is Worldviews. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzak Rolat. For nearly 500 years, British monarchs have gathered nearly 250,000 pieces of art to form the royal collection. Desmond Shaw Taylor has overseen roughly 7,000 oil paintings and 3,000 miniatures as the surveyor of the Queen's pictures since 2005. He visited Oklahoma recently with Anna Summers Cox. For the past 23 years, she served as the founding editor and CEO of the Art Newspaper, a publication for museum professionals, collectors, and lawyers who specialize in cultural property issues. Desmond Shaw Taylor and Anna Summers Cox, welcome to Worldviews.
Great to be here.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, Mr. Shaw Taylor, I know that you are involved with overseeing, managing the Queen Elizabeth's art collection. Tell us a little bit about that art collection and kind of what you see, who gets to see it? Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, it's really one of the greatest art collections that somehow kind of passed under the radar. Actually, you can see it in lots of places. You can see it at Buckingham Palace during the summer, Buckingham Palace summer opening. You can see it all year round at Windsor Castle, and also at Hampton Court and Kensington Palace and Holyrood Palace in Edinburgh, and also other places less well known. So what I think people don't necessarily realize is that the artworks in all those places belongs to this one collection, the Royal Collection.
And so what exactly is in the collection? Does it vary in terms of the type of art, the period of art?
It's the accumulation of things acquired by the British monarchy since it started. So it's unbelievable in
so
its
things
range.
paintings,
for example, but paintings represent a relative I'm the surveyor of the Queen's pictures, so I look after the paintings, and it's one of the most important collections of paintings in the world. But the paintings represent an actually very small part of the collection as a whole, because there's furniture, the crown jewels, for example, is part of the royal collection, ceramics,
What about fashion?
There's a dress collection that's held at Kensington Palace, and it's a absolutely fabulous dress collection, including, of course, very, very important coronation dresses and so on, but also court dress from the 18th and 19th century. Jewellery, magnificent jewellery, and also works on paper. The Royal Library has one of the best collections in the world of Italian Old Master drawings, including 600 drawings by Leonardo da Vinci.
Very interesting. So what does this say then about the British monarchy? I mean, is it really these things, as you put them, these various works of art, I guess, are reflective of the history of the monarchy and the kinds of things that were interesting to them over its
exactly
rule?
And it's really almost not one history. It's several histories, because there's sometimes no connection between what one monarch will have collected or commissioned, and so, for example, the Charles I was really the first great collector of British monarchs, and it tells you that collectors are not necessarily good kings. I mean, he fought in the Civil War and was tried and beheaded, so his rule was not entirely successful, but his art collecting was extremely successful. What he was collecting, basically Italian Renaissance art, that fundamentally different from what, for example, Queen Victoria and Prince Albert were collecting in the mid 19th century.
So definitely different histories. That's interesting. I connect them to different monarchs as time goes by.
Different monarchs, different histories, exactly.
Yeah. Well, Ms. Summers Cox, you have been involved in the art world for many years. I'd like to connect what we've heard from Mr. Shaw Taylor about private collections the collections of the rich and famous, if you will, the monarch, to public collections and the connection between the two, the distinction between the two. I mean, you know, we tend to think of art often as something that the rich really pay attention to, or that how is it accessible to the public, and how would you make a distinction between these kinds of collections?
If you look at almost any great museum, it starts either with collections of private individuals or else with the heads of state. For example, the Louvre is a collection essentially of the kings of France, and then it becomes a state organization and begins to acquire as a government organization. But at the essence of it is one collecting power that happens to span generations. Alternatively, I mean, the British Museum starts off with a collection of a man called Sir Hans Sloane. So private collections have a way of becoming public collections. I mean, this happens to an amazing extent in America, where people give their collections. If you go around the Met in New York, it's like a kind of series of chapels devoted to various donors, galleries that have not just been financed, but actually been filled with works of art collected. So I think that there's a transition between the two. What is changing now, I've noticed, is that actually quite a lot of private collectors are beginning to open their own museums. I mean, Eli Broad, for example, in California. François Pinault's done it in Venice, the French luxury, he owns Christie's, you know, he's a millionaire collector. And some of them are very, very good at having outreach programs, and some of them are less good at having outreach programs,
So I have to ask, I mean, in today's economy, is art something that you see as less accessible or less of interest? People selling off their private collections, are they likely to give them up, perhaps? Is the collection of art something people do less and less because of the economy? Is there a connection at all between economic situations and access to or interest in art?
I at the moment, we're living through an extraordinary period, because the middle classes are getting squeezed, the poor are having a harder time, but the very rich are getting richer. And because there's a shortage of good vehicles for investment, you find rich people buying works of art, very expensive works of art, and some of them go straight into the free port in Geneva or Singapore. But some other people who have a bit more of a sense of the fun of life, then you put them on show, either lending them to museums or else creating a museum for them.
My guests are Anna Summers Cox of the Art Newspaper and Desmond Shaw Taylor, who serves as surveyor of the Queen's pictures and curates a significant portion of the British monarch's art collection. Let's take a short break and then we'll talk some more. I'm Suzette Grelot, and this is Worldviews. You're listening to Worldviews on KGOU. I'm Suzette Grelot, the Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. I'm speaking today with Desmond Shaw Taylor of the Royal Collection of Art and the founding editor and CEO of the art newspaper, Anna Summers Cox. Just before the break, she described how more and more wealthy collectors are buying art specifically to loan to museums or building their own spaces to exhibit their investments. I wonder if this relates at all to another issue that, and again, forgive me, I have to ask this question because it's in the news often, that art is often a target of crime, and that you see, because the value of these works of art is fairly sustainable, that they then become a key piece for theft, and that there's this market for black market work. Do you see this at all, or is there a connection that we can make there?
Interesting enough, given the amount of art that there is around in private hands, the number of thefts is really quite small, and you hear about them precisely because they are so extraordinary. The more important a work of art, the less likely you're going to be able to sell it in any kind of honest way. Therefore, it'll have to disappear into a kind of underworld of shady dealings, sometimes traded against drugs. We know that that has happened. That being said, there remain some mysterious things. I mean, the Isabella Stewart Gardner, it's now at least 20, maybe 30 years since a number of unbelievable masterpieces were stolen from there, and they've never surfaced.
Never recovered them. And so, who knows? They're hiding away in someone's house somewhere and will resurface at some point? Or
the worst possible thing that could have happened would be that the people who stole them didn't really know enough about the art market to realize that they were unsaleable, and that they panicked and stashed them somewhere, like in a sort of damp basement, or worse still, just destroy them.
I'd like to see if both of you can answer a question about contemporary attempts to maybe digitize works of art and share them more broadly outside of museums. So establishing kind of digital or video presentations of art exhibits. Do you see that happening often? And particularly with you, Mr. Shaw Taylor, in your exhibit, I mean, the Queen's work, I mean, are these things available to see more broadly on the internet, for example?
Yes, we are at the moment engaged in putting as much of the collection as possible online. Certainly now, all paintings have a record online, so you can see that it exists. They don't necessarily have a photograph, but they will. And the rest of the collection is we're working through it. So, no, that's hugely important to us. And we've realized, really, that once you commit to that and once there is the quality of photography available, and when it's digital, it really does last forever. I think we've really recognized the scale of the enterprise. So give us a bit of time and we will be there. And as an advance, it's unbelievable because this is just making it available to everybody.
And Desmond, there's a very nice thing that the Royal Collection does, which is it lets scholars reproduce works of art from the collection without charging a fee for that, which is a very positive development in museums lately. It started off with the Victoria and Albert Museum in London, and now the Met does it, and I think MoMA and British Museum, because it had become terribly expensive for people to reproduce works of art in their in academic books, and they realised that and they've waived it. And the other project, which I think is wonderful, and I only started using it the other day, is the Google Art Project, where they have entire collections of museums online in very, very, very high resolution images, so that you can zoom right in as though, you know, you had your eye 1 inch away from a ceramic. So you can practically have the experience of holding it in your hand. I was looking at a medieval capital from a column this way, and I got so excited. I thought, my goodness me, this has got over the problem that you can't ever in a museum get really close enough to something.
Right. But doesn't it still change the experience in some ways? I mean, it's a trade-off, right? You get to see it that up close and personal and in your own time and in your own space, and makes it all the more accessible, as we were suggesting. But then is there something very, very kind of fundamentally different about seeing something digitally as opposed to seeing, you know, the actual, you know, work of art in,
sure,
in the Uffizi?
One trades off the other. I think every work of art exists in 100 different manifestations. So if you think of a piece of music, you would completely accept that you would have it as a CD or electronically, as well as something that you could play or something that you could go and hear other people play live. That's, I think, the essence of a work of art. Its soul is released from the actual object. But then you go and see the object and you get the physical experience. It's,
so it lives beyond that actual physical space. Well, I'm curious. I mean, we're talking about art and particularly the work that you're doing in the developed world. What do you see developing in developing parts of the world in terms of art and museums and an appreciation for that that kind of art? For example, in countries like Iraq or Afghanistan, I mean, are we seeing, you know, an increase in an interest in art and art museums in some of these parts of the world?
Yes, very much so. I'd say not Afghanistan, poor things. They're having such a bad time. And also they are, quite honestly, living, you know, a couple of centuries behind us. And anything that happens there in the artistic way is, in a sense, a kind of colonial, not exactly an imposition, but a kind of graft on. But Iraq, we forget that Iraq actually had a very thriving art scene in the 50s and 60s, which was completely smashed up by the war and is coming back to life now and is beginning to actually have galleries and so on. The driver of the art scene in the Middle East has been the Gulf. The Arabs of the Gulf, of course, until recently were dirt poor and had nothing. I mean, really, practically, you know, they lived in tents or sort of huts. But now they have become interested in art and they have having these museums being built. And a little art market is beginning to develop there. And they are deliberately trying to favour art of the Middle East. So, for example, in Qatar, which most people know because it produces Al Jazeera television, there is a museum devoted to Arab art of the Middle East, from all over the Middle East. And it really needs relatively little to get an art scene going and in encouraging people. And they have art colleges there, as indeed they have art colleges in Egypt and Jordan and so on. And it's a good way of expressing political feeling without incurring the wrath of the authorities, because generally speaking, the authorities can read, but quite often they can't really interpret art. So that's one thing. And of course, Africa is definitely a coming art scene. There are some galleries there, but there are Westerners who are interested in the art. There's a man called Johnny Pigozzi, for example, who never goes there himself, but he actually sends a curator down there who gives artists paints and so on and encourages them and buys their work.
Well, I think it goes without saying, you know, art really is and should be for everyone. So it's interesting to hear about the developments in other parts of the world as well. Well, Desmond Shaw Taylor, Anna Summers Cox, thank you so much for being with us on Worldviews today.
Great pleasure.
Thank you very much.
You've been listening to my conversation with British art historians Desmond Shaw Taylor and Anna Summers Cox. You can explore the Royal Collection of Art by visiting our website, kgou.org. Worldviews is a production of the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies through a collaborative partnership with KGOU. Mackenzie Samus prepared the research for this interview, Brian Hardzinski is our producer and editor, and our digital content intern for the summer is Holly Arias. We'll continue to report next week from Ankara, Turkey. For Joshua Landis, I'm Suzette Gralat.